welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. As usual, support those that support us. We really appreciate it. I'm going to get right into it today. I'm very privileged to welcome Professor of Psychology from Harvard University, Joshua Green. The book is Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them, available on Amazon. You can also follow him at joshua-green, G-R-E-E-N-E.net. Dr. Green, welcome to the program.
Hi.
I really appreciate you being here. I heard you on other podcasts, I think probably Rashly Speaking or something like that, and I thought, oh, my God, I got to talk to you some more. This is fantastic.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I remember you from years ago, from Loveline, going all the way back to the 90s.
So that is us.
Thanks for all your good advice.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Dr. Green is involved in research and writing largely connected to moral judgment, decision-making. He also very much involved in cognitive science. And we live in a time when, you know, the notion of tribe and tribalism and ideological sort of, what should we call it, the cognitive dissonance and the distortions that are going around in the world today are just overwhelming. So I'll let you start the conversation with where your interest lies today.
Well, I guess for a long time I was trying to formulate my own diagnosis of moral problems. That is, where do they come from on a more proximate psychological level? That is, what's going on in our heads when we're making the kinds of decisions that get us into trouble, and also on a deeper evolutionary level, where both biological evolution and cultural evolution, what's the deeper history of the things that divide us? And now I'm, increasingly trying to think, what can we do? How can we use the things that we've learned to try to make some progress? And that of course is much more challenging. But that's what I've been thinking about.
I recently heard, was it Jonathan Haidt? Is that how you pronounce his name? Social psychologist talking about sort of the currency of outrage and the currency of prestige in sort of calling out members of the out-group. Are you doing much thinking about that?
Well, I think it's part of a larger picture. That is, there's a lot of, another way of, a term people often use is signaling, right? That is, when we say something, we may be trying to express what we believe to be the truth, but we're also trying to send signals to other people about what kind of people we are. And, there may be situations in which, one might be open to certain ideas, but if the people who one depends on most are completely opposed to those ideas, or they think everybody else is, then it makes it much harder to express them, and then makes it much harder for people on either side to find a kind of common ground.
Which is the description of the world we're in right now.
Yeah, I think that's at least one big part of it.
That's one big part. What else we got?
Well, there's a kind of chicken and egg problem when it comes to people's information universes. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, obviously, about fake news, but the recent explosion in interest in misinformation under that term is really kind of just, I think, coming to a head of problems that have been brewing for a long time, where if people only get information from sources that they trust, and the sources that they trust are the sources that confirm what they already believe, then, that creates a kind of vicious cycle where people get to the point where you can't even really have what seems to you to be a reasonable or rational conversation with somebody from the other side, because you have such wildly different assumptions, right? So, when it comes to things like gun control, if you ask liberals, what percentage of gun deaths in the United States do you think are caused by assault-style weapons? You'll get an extremely high number, like 35%. If you ask conservatives, particularly conservatives who know a lot about guns, they'll give you a much lower number, something more like 2%. It turns out that in that case, I picked an example where the conservatives are more likely to be right and the liberals are more likely to be wrong. There are cases where it goes the other direction, like in what country was Barack Obama born in? But you know, when people are starting with such radically different assumptions, it's hard to even know where to start or make any kind of headway on a rational conversation.
Right, and this is this world where they feel a certain way, right? It's almost like it's a psychological issue rather than a issue of data or reality. Even it's just they feel like it is so, therefore it is so, and it's a problem that has to be solved psychologically. No.
Yeah, I mean that you know we're not most of us. You know, it wouldn't be possible, not even close, for ordinary citizens to master all of the details that are necessary to have informed opinions about any of the complicated issues that we face. Right? I mean, if you ask a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, to explain how it works, odds are they really can't give a very good explanation.
Right.
Nor can someone who's opposed to it. Right. You know, and that's a lot to ask of people because people have lives and they don't have training in healthcare policy, and that's
right.
Just one small example. So we rely on our sense of what sounds like the right answer based on general feel and based on what the people we trust, the people around us, either literally or in our information world, seem to be saying, and that's what we go with. Another example along those lines is climate change. That if you looked at surveys from the late 90s, when this was just becoming a public issue, Republicans and Democrats were about equally likely to believe that climate change was something that needed to be taken seriously. And then it became a kind of partisan badge of honor, especially on the Republican side, to say that climate change is a hoax and it's a manufactured thing by Democrats. And, you know, of course, typical people on either side, they don't know all of the details or even most of the details, but it just becomes a signal for which side are you on.
Right. And that's going back to the tribalism now, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the epistemic, the informational side of tribalism. And most of the issues that divide us, they're not about concrete things that are right in front of us. They're about things that, you know, we can't see with our own eyes. And so we have to rely on what others are telling us, either other people or more institutionalized information sources.
Well, it's a strange thing in a day when expertise means nothing, right? Experts, in fact, are specifically distrusted. Go ahead.
I don't think the distrust of, you know, experts is evenly distributed. I mean, I think that an increasingly large part of the ethos on the conservative side of the spectrum is a distrust of elites, which includes what we would at least traditionally think of as experts. Whereas, you know, there are certainly cases on the more liberal side where people distrust experts, perhaps the most often discussed example being attitudes, anti-vaccination attitudes and beliefs, which is primarily, although not exclusively, a liberal phenomenon. So it can go both ways, but for the most part, I think people on the left side of things are relatively comfortable with experts as, you know, traditionally conceived, where there's much more skepticism from experts, especially when it comes to certain hot button issues like climate change and things like that, on the right side of the political spectrum.
I just think we have a rash of Dunning-Kruger phenomenon amongst the population.
Right.
Yeah, I really do. And for the couple things I want to elaborate for the listeners, Dunning-Kruger is essentially a cognitive distortion where you think you have all the information, you rely on your own judgment about it, and you know nothing. It's what gets people to stand up in front of American Idol and sing like crap. It's because they have no scale upon which to measure their experience and no feedback from the environment about their actual knowledge base. And because we have these things in our hand, these phones that make us feel like we are experts in anything just by virtue of a Google search and are really experts in nothing, to me that's how you create Dunning-Kruger. And I just see lots of it in millennials.
Yes. Yeah. The people are surprised. You know, some of the research I'm doing now involves asking people questions about some of these issues, and you know, some people, when you ask them questions where they think they know the answer and they actually don't, and we try to, you know, we make it so that there are things to challenge the liberals and things to challenge the conservatives. Some people are really frustrated and you know, really fight back when you tell them, you know, for example, that relatively few gun deaths in the United States are caused by assault weapons. Other people find it very interesting and illuminating, but certainly people's confidence it exceeds their knowledge.
Well, my sense is that you almost have to approach people to change their opinions by changing or addressing their view of the world. You know, they attach their entire worldview to these opinions. I always use the flat earthers as my example, as the most sort of outrageous distortions. And I think, how would I explain myself to them how I would have to change my worldview, for instance, if their worldview were correct? All the laws of physics and mathematics would have to not function. And the phone they have in their hand would, of course, not work, because all those laws of physics that we use to develop that don't work if he has a flat earth. And so I imagine having the conversation that way, and yet I'm not sure it would get anywhere.
Right. Yeah. And I think in some ways, it's, you know, as you said, there's this broader web of beliefs that's kind of behind people's misconceptions.
Yeah.
But I think to a large extent, it's social. And I, on the one hand, armed with an array of facts, it's almost impossible to get somebody to change their mind if they're firmly committed to something.
All right, I want you to drill in on that, because I heard you say that in a previous podcast, and to repeat that and tell people what you mean by that and what the alternative is.
Well, it's related to what you said, right? That if you say, look, climate change is real, so you read this article, and they would say, oh, but that's in the New York Times. That's just liberal propaganda. Then you say, well, how do you know that it's liberal propaganda? And you know, you'd have to follow a chain of beliefs back to very basic things where people might not even remember where the original sources of their expectations about who you can trust and who you can't came from.
But it's weird to us as scientists, because we're trained to evaluate data, evaluate the analysis, evaluate the experimentation, read broadly in the whole area to get all the different studies that have been done, so we get a sense of the landscape, and to evaluate it strictly objectively. To talk about persuasion in that setting is like anathema. It's like, wait, what? I just looking at the data. It's the data and the analysis of the data, the construction of the experiment, the thinking that went into it. That's all that matters.
Right.
But not for the average person, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, to some extent, you know, scientists are willing to dig deeper and sort of, you know, try to have a broader coherent view. But to a large extent, in the day-to-day operations of science, we actually don't have to deal with that, because we're mostly dealing with people who share our background assumptions, and then we're debating some next little new question about, you know, whether things break to the left or break to the right, so to speak.
Yeah.
In some ways, an analogy would be like trying to explain, you know, some new scientific result to someone who is, you know, emerged from a hunter-gathering society, right? where you know, you could say the words and sort of, you know, read the description of what was just found out about earthquakes or hurricanes or DNA or whatever it is, but then you have to explain, well, what's a molecule, and what's a nucleotide, and what are cells, and right? You know, there's so much background information that we just take for granted, and now on in the political sphere, it's as if, you know, there are these two separate basic bodies of knowledge and understanding, and that makes it very hard to have a discussion about anything without having a discussion about everything.
Can you describe for people the famous experiment in the 50s with the grammar school age boys, or was it young adolescent boys, where they went to the camp and put them into two different with the eagles and the snakes, whatever it was?
Exactly. This gets at, I think, a more optimistic view, that is that fortunately you may not have to convince everybody of everything, you just have to make friends.
Right.
And so I'll provide some of the background. So what you're describing is this experiment done by a psychologist couple, Sharif and Sharif, and this is known as the Robber's Cave experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they brought a group of boys to this boys' camp that they took over for the summer, and they divided the boys into two groups, and the boys got to each name their teams. One decided to call themselves the Eagles, the other decided to call themselves the Rattlers, and over the course of the summer, they were always in competition with each other, competition in the playing field, competition for following the rules.
And by the way, as I understand, they didn't even know about each other, but as soon as they found out about the other team, they immediately imagined competing with them in some way, right?
Oh, is that right? I thought it's been a while since I looked at the details. Yeah. But
that's how I understand it. I haven't looked at it either, but that's my recollection. But go ahead.
So the gist, which I think is consistent with both versions, is that they were ultimately by being separated in this way, and perhaps being encouraged or required to compete against each other, really developed pretty nasty attitudes, and they had.
And these were kids. These were kids were matched by age and family background.
Right.
And they were very much could not be more alike one another, and yet immediately perceived differences merely because one was on one island, the other was on the other island.
Right. Exactly. And raiding each other's cabins. And at some point, the researchers decided, okay, this is actually getting a little bit out of hand, and they wanted to bring the researchers, the kids back together. And so what they did was they had them, among other things, do some joint tasks together, like pulling a truck out of the mud where they all the kids had to pull, or they weren't going to be able to get the truck out. And with just relatively modest interventions of this time, completely turn the attitudes of the kids around. So I think it's interesting that you brought up that example, because I think that hits the nail right on the head, that the trick to bringing people together is not to give good arguments necessarily. I mean that's the finishing touch, but that only becomes possible. Your brain is only receptive to what might be a good argument once you're already in a situation where you feel like the person I'm talking to is someone who's on my side, someone who's part of my who's part of my team. So I think the real question is, how do we get the people on either side of this massive divide in the United States, and of course this is happening in other countries, to feel like, and in some sense legitimately recognize, that their interests are aligned, that they are on the same team.
Without needing a common task or a common enemy.
Yeah, right. Hopefully we don't need aliens attack or something to bring us together. But some kind of common cause where people sort of recognize that the person on the other side is a valuable cooperation partner.
So what are you suggesting?
Well, I don't mean to be coy. I have some research on this that's ongoing right now, but it's not published, so I can't really talk about it. But I do have some specific ideas.
You give us some broad?
In broad outline.
Yeah, in broad strokes, because I'm pessimistic and I'm upset all the time, and I find it extremely unpleasant what's going on, and so I want to know that there's a way out other than being attacked from outside.
Yeah. Rather than talking about the research going on in my lab right now, I'll say where if things go the way I hope or expect or hypothesize with the work that we're doing, what would be a kind of implication of that? Mm. I think that having some kind of work program where people with different coming from sort of different cultural backgrounds and political views.
Why don't we just call that let's give it a name. Let's call it the military. Something like that.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, right? The military was one of the first institutions in American life to be relatively successfully integrated, racially speaking.
Yeah.
And, it didn't happen because out of the goodness of the military brass's hearts, that they wanted more bodies for fighting, but the bodies had to get along with each other in order to do that, and that meant having a structure that was designed to make that happen. And I'm not an expert on by any means on the history of the military and integration in the military. But I think you hit it right on the head. The other classic example of this is sports. That if sports teams are competing against each other for top talent, and there's just no denying if someone is an excellent athlete, regardless of their race or religion, then there's a very strong incentive to make use of those talents. And you know, so again, not to say that the history of sports doesn't have plenty of racism in it, but relative to other domains of American life,
yeah,
professional sports and the military were early to integrate, and it's because frankly the kind of, you would think of it as the strategy or the economics of it dictated it from the top, and then the institutions made it happen. Okay, so then that raises the question, right? Is obviously we're not going to have the whole nation playing baseball or hopefully not fighting a war, but what would have the equivalent psychological effect?
Right, I get it.
Right.
Well, Hydrolyte, do not let the dropping temperatures fool you. You can get dehydrated now, especially when you work out hard. And look, you don't feel as well. You don't perform as well unless you stay ahead with your hydration. If you listen to my shows, you know I love Hydrolyte. I first found out about Hydrolyte when they sent samples to my medical office. I noted then that it was exactly what I've been looking for oral rehydration for patients with serious volume depletion. I tried it, I was impressed, and I reached out to find out a way we could work together. 2 years later, I am still using this almost every day. My family uses it, my patients use it. Quite simply, Hydrolyte is the best oral rehydration product I've ever seen. It provides the proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water, and compared to sports drinks, Hydrolyte delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. It's appropriate for all ages. Each package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. Hydrolyte comes in great flavors like orange, berry, and lemonade, and it's available in a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or, of course, the effervescent tablets you simply drop in a bottle or a glass of water. I love this stuff. I literally don't leave home without it. You can find Hydrolyte at Rite Aid or at Hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew, D-R-D-R-E-W. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 30% on Hydrolyte. If you click through the banner on my website at drdrew.com, then use the code DrDrew18, D-R-D-R-E-W-18, at checkout. So you can either do my website or Hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew, and then in both cases, use that code DrDrew18 for the 30% discount. Pluto TV, leading free streaming television service. Watch over 100 channels, thousands of movies on demand and completely free. Never ask you for anything. You just download the app and boom, the menu comes up. It's ridiculous. By the time I finish this ad, anyone listening, you should have that app on your phone. You will be stunned. When I did it, I couldn't believe it. They didn't ask for a sign up. They didn't ask for money. What are you waiting for? You never pay for TV again by downloading Pluto TV. And you can download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today, including phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, Smart TV, PlayStation. Anywhere you stream, you get that Pluto TV. It's the leading streaming television service. Pluto TV. Watch over 100 TV channels, thousands of movies on demand, no credit card needed, no sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV free on all your favorite devices. Do it now. I guarantee you, you'll be as stunned as I was what immediately is available to you right now for free. Purple is a great mattress. That's it. That's all I got to say. We have it at our house. We use it when guests come over and they rave about it. They literally always ask us, what kind of mattress? What is this? It feels different than anything you've ever experienced. It's a brand new material developed by an actual rocket scientist, not like the memory foam you're used to. It's unique because it's both firm and soft at the same time. It supports you right where you need support. And that's what everyone reports to us when they wake up in the morning. And, of course, they have their 100-night risk-free trial. 100-night risk-free trial. If you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. It's backed by a 10-year warranty, free shipping and returns. It shows up. It's a thing you unroll right under the bed, and boom, you got your mattress. You're going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great gifts they're offering site-wide. Just text the word Drew to the number 474747. The only way you get that free pillow is to text Drew to 474747. One more time, Drew, D-E-R-R-Y-W, to 474747. Let's go. Let's go. Your book is called Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us. And so I'm imagining in there you drill into moral decision making and morality generally. Yeah. And tell me more about, you know, what your, I mean, you're a PhD is in philosophy originally, right? And yeah. So I'm wondering what your notion of morality is. Are you sort of, is this a Kantian, a Humean, a neurobiological? Where are you?
I'm a utilitarian, but I hate the word utilitarian because it sounds like a lot of things that I don't think are the right things to think about, like the laundry room or the idea of, you know, it's very hard to get excited about utility. You can, you know, march in the streets for rights and justice, but no one ever marched for utility.
For maximum utility.
Right. Yeah. So my I hate to call it this, but for lack of a better term, rebranding of utilitarianism is what I call deep pragmatism.
Oh.
Which I think just...
So like that's
conveyed.
like purse.
A pragmatist. There are aspects of Peirce's philosophy, if I recall correctly, from the limited exposure I've had to it, that I'm not so keen on. The sort of American pragmatists, many of them, in addition to being pragmatic in the ordinary colloquial sense, had a what we call a pragmatist theory of truth, where the idea is that what is true is what's good for us to believe. And
I think it's more what's true is what's pragmatically relevant or useful, pragmatically useful, right?
Fair enough. Yeah. I take issue with that idea. I'm kind of an old-fashioned, what philosophers call, correspondence theory of truth person. I think that what it means for something to be true or a statement to be true is that it corresponds to reality. And there may be truths that if we believe them, it won't be good for us. But that doesn't mean they're not true.
Right.
But this is kind of a side issue. I think I am a kind of pragmatist in the colloquial sense. But I think one thing I don't like about pragmatism in the colloquial sense is that it suggests a kind of expediency or superficiality. That is, you don't have any deep convictions. You're just trying to get a certain job done or something like that.
Right.
And so the reason why I like to think of utilitarianism as deep pragmatism is because it's pragmatic in the sense of being ultimately about producing good consequences for all concerned. But it's not pragmatic in the sense of lacking a deep moral core. So the basic idea, and it's really sort of two ideas put together. One, which is I think is a core idea of every modern moral philosophy, or nearly all of them, is impartiality. That is that at least if we're going to have some basis for making decisions in a large scale society, the rules have to be impartial. They have to give everybody's interests equal weight. You can't say, this is what we should do because it's better for me and I'm me and therefore that's what we should do. That's one thing. But then the question is, all right, but how do you weigh competing interests? How do you decide if this person's right to freedom conflicts with somebody else's right to security or to not be offended? How do you weigh those things?
Right.
And the utilitarian answer is the ultimate currency for the things that we care about is the quality of people's experience, which you can call happiness or happiness minus suffering. I think that can be misleading as well. But I think the best way to think of it is start with anything that you care about and keep asking why do you care about that until you run out of answers, right? So if you say, oh, you went to work today, why'd you go to work? You say, well, I enjoy my work, but also, you know, I need to make money. You say, well, why do you care about money? Well, you know, I need to pay the rent. I'm like, well, what do you need the rent for? Why can't you just live outside? Well, it's cold. Well, what's wrong with being cold? Well, it's painful. You say, well, what's wrong with pain? Well, it's just bad, right?
Hmm.
And the idea is that if you sort of chase down all of those whys, with anything you value, you'll ultimately come down to the quality of your experience or the experience of someone you care about. So you put those two things together and you say, okay, everybody matters equally, and what really matters for everybody is the quality of people's experience.
Okay.
You put those two things together, and that is essentially utilitarianism. Again, terrible name for a good philosophy, and I prefer to call it deep pragmatism. But if you're a deep pragmatist, then what it really means is that what you're ultimately trying to do is make the world as happy as possible. And what that most urgently means is eliminating as much suffering as possible.
Well, so I'm about to stop you. So I'm not sure happiness is the opposite of suffering, and I'm not sure what you mean by happiness yet.
Yeah.
Are you talking about eudaimonic happiness or hedonic happiness or just euphoria? I mean, what do we mean when we say happiness?
When I say happiness in this context, I mean the quality or the positive quality of lived experience. So when you say happiness, people tend to think of, you know, kind of like my favorite things from The Sound of Music, right? The things that immediately put smiles on your faces, right? And those things may make you happy, but those aren't the only things that affect your happiness, right? You don't think of, you know, fixing the brakes on your car as something you do for your happiness. But of course, if you didn't fix the brakes on your car, you'd be a lot less happy, and other people might be as well. So, you know, you wouldn't necessarily describe all of these other values, right, as being about happiness. But what I mean by happiness is, as a value, is that it's, again, anything
that's not unpleasant.
Anything that affects the quality of your lived experience,
you're going really positive and negative valence. You're just putting a valence on it, really. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. That's, I think, the clearest, if not most, colloquial way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And so, I had something else. I lost my train of thought on the issue of positive and negative valence. It's not coming back to me. Well, in any event, how do we – I know I was going to ask you. So this the phenomenology of this, do you think it is merely a neurobiological expression of our evolutionary adaptedness and just increases the probability of the species moving forward in a social context?
So I think that the origin of our positive and negative mental states, those are essentially the carrots and the sticks that our brains use to get us to do things, either to avoid things that are bad for us or to do things that are good for us, like, you know, eat food and don't touch fire and things like that. However, humans are especially unusual in that, you know, our niche, the way that we survive in a wide range of environments, is by being very behaviorally flexible, right? So, you know, we can make clothing and we can build boats and we can sing songs and we can do all kinds of things that might increase our fitness in the biological sense. But these things are too complicated to have all the answers encoded in our genes, where we're operating on kind of hardwired instincts, right?
Right.
And so what this means is that what we have is a general desire for our own well-being, and because we survive by cooperating with other people, we have a desire for the well-being of at least some other people, maybe lots of other people, the more generous we're feeling. And we have brains that enable us to solve complicated problems that nature couldn't have anticipated. And this gives us the capacity to have values that supersede the sort of core biological value of passing on our genes. So to make all of this much more clear, let me give you a clear example. So take the case of birth control, right? Mm-hmm. Birth control is essentially our brains kind of turning their own nature on its head, so to speak, right? That is, if there's one thing that your genes, so to speak, don't want you to do, it's take a pill that's going to make it so that you can't make more copies of your gene.
Well, unless there's a priority for the overall genetic load of the species, and we're endangering that with overpopulation.
So that would be one explanation. But I don't think that that's what's going on here. That is, we didn't evolve birth control in order to limit the human population because it was hindering the spread of our genes somehow.
We didn't think that's what we were doing anyway.
Right. Well, yeah. If maybe there's a there's a hidden agenda we don't know about. But I think the most straightforward story is that nature made us enjoy having sex for various fairly straightforward biological reasons, and some more complicated reasons having to do with the role that sex plays, not just in procreation, but in human relationships. And then then humans decided that, you know, rather than having lots and lots and lots of babies, what we'd like is to have babies when we want to have them, and maybe not have as many as we could have, and that we would actually enjoy our lives more, having more control, and not doing the sexual equivalent of, you know, always eating when we're hungry, so to speak.
And theoretically, that could help improve productivity of the offspring too, right? I mean, it could help the way we raise kids, and it could change the way that, you know, the next generation is. It could improve the outcome for the next generation, theoretically.
It could.
Yeah.
But in developed countries, in a lot of developed countries, population growth is actually falling below replacement rate. So in many parts of Europe, you know, people are, the population or the native population is actually dwindling. So in principle, that could be possible, but I think that's not actually what's happening.
Okay,
instead, I think what's happening is we used our big fancy primate brains to figure out how to get something that we want. In other words, how to get those enjoyment signals out of life without doing the thing that the enjoyment signals, at least a lot of them, were designed to get us to do, right? So you can have the enjoyment benefits of having sex, both the physical pleasure of it and the relationship benefits and all of those things, without actually making more babies that you then have to take care of.
Right.
So the point is that, you know, we can kind of climb the evolutionary ladder and then kick it away. At least I think that's what we've done for now, with our reproductive technology. That's not to say that it will last. That is to say, you know, there could be some groups that are opposed to birth control, and then those groups are more likely to grow and grow and grow and ultimately take over. And we see some signs of this in some cultures, where groups that for various reasons are intent on having more children end up become larger and larger, a larger and larger proportion of the population. Take, for example, Orthodox Jews, the Haredi in Israel. But coming back to sort of the main point is that, as I would think, the case of birth control illustrates, we may have certain innate tendencies, but we also have a very flexible kind of intelligence that enables us to do things that might ultimately even subvert the goals of evolution. That we are not necessarily doomed to be warring tribalists or whatever it is that, morally speaking, we're afraid that we are. But it also may be an uphill battle if those are our natural tendencies.
So I'm still trying to get back to the solution without you exposing your research. So morality, it's okay. I get it. I kind of get the sense of what the solution is.
Yeah.
I just don't know that you're going to get everyone to, you know, a massive adoption of that kind of a
solution. No, I think it's a long haul. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to back off of this reasoning for a second and just sort of look at historical sweeps of when tribalism has emerged. Do you see other historical moments that have had similar degrees of tribalism?
Well, I think it's actually the story of most of human history.
Right.
That is, you know, for the idea of valuing all human lives equally, or even aspiring to, that's a very new idea. And even though it's been around for, you know, a few hundred years in the Western tradition, it's not one that too many people really live up to, even as many of us aspire to it. So I think, you know, like, tribalism is kind of the natural way, and, you know, what we have achieved, I think, is a fragile, increasingly strained state where we have good enough institutions that can enable people who are from very different tribes to live productively together. And, you know, what I worry about, and a lot of other people these days, is that those mechanisms that enable us to have this pluralistic, large-scale society, that they are really under stress.
And is there a reason currently? Do you see an underlying? I mean, this is sort of a very vague question, but
no, I think a lot of it has to do with technology, in particular communication technology. So, you know, you're old enough to remember Walter Cronkite, and you know, there was a time when. You know, there were relatively few sources of information, and you know, everybody watched the evening news, right? And Cronkite used to end his newscast where he said, "And that's the way it is," right?
Yeah.
And, you know, no one questioned that, right? He was the most trusted man in America, right? And you know, he's kind of an icon of an era when people disagreed about what was better or what was worse, but there was a fairly robust, shared, you know, body of information. And then, you know, first came radio, and then the internet, and then the kind of enhancement of the internet with social media. And these technologies have enabled people to increasingly choose where they get their information from and to focus their attention on sources that reinforce whatever it is that they already believe. And so the proliferation of options for getting the information that determines our worldview, while in principle can bring us all together because we're more free, we have more options, it enabled us to get polarized in the way that we're seeing. Another way of putting it is that social media and everything leading up to it, it's great in the fight against dictatorships, right? Where they want to try to control everything through the one state-sponsored radio broadcast or whatever it is. But it seems to be cutting the other way in more developed democracies where people have the freedom to choose, you know, what they hear.
And this is not a uniquely American experience, the polarization.
No.
Right? Yeah.
No. I mean, we see this especially in Europe. And you know, countries like Hungary and Poland have really gone very far in this kind of, for lack of a better term, fascist direction.
TheraWorks is a product I have been talking about now because I'm excited that we can finally relieve muscle cramps. And this sounds like a trivial issue, but if you're one of these people that have nocturnal cramps, it's disruptive, it is painful, and sleep is such an important health issue. You can't catch up. You can't ever get good sleep. And, of course, exercise is important, and I have patients that can't exercise because of cramps. Well, that's why I endorse TheraWorks Relief. It's a non-greasy foam, clinically proven to relieve muscle cramps fast, reduce muscle soreness, and with daily use, TheraWorks Relief can prevent the cramps before they start. This will give you a full night's sleep or set you up to be able to do the activities you love and exercise and not be sidelined by cramps. TheraWorks Relief only takes minutes to apply. It absorbs quickly, and it works. I recommend TheraWorks Relief to my family, friends, patients, and then they pass it around to their friends and family. It's kind of extraordinary. TheraWorks Relief is my choice for preventing and relieving muscle cramps. Make it yours, too. Get TheraWorks Relief in the pain relief aisle at Walmart, CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, or by talking to your pharmacist. They're excited, as I am, because they don't have to use medication any longer to treat cramps. Learn more at TheraWorksRelief.com. That is TheraWorksRelief.com for your muscle cramps. If you're starting the process of buying a car, well, you've been hit with all these terms like MSRP and invoice and list price and dealer price. I still don't know what these things mean. But what you really want is, what are you going to pay? What actually is the price, the true price from TrueCar now? You'll know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you get to the dealership. TrueCar will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of your home. How do you know True Price is a great price? Because True Car shows you what other people pay for the car you want. There's that scattergram, so you're educated about the price range. You know you've locked in a good price. And when you lock in that price, it's for an actual vehicle on a TrueCar certified dealer's lot. It's not some potential car. It is a specific car. And your certified dealers know this, so they set that true price competitively so they can win your business. So when you're ready to buy new or used, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. The Lady Gang podcast on Podcast One now is a new TV show on E! Watch it Sundays. And if you can't get enough of your favorite lady podcaster, then listen to First Degree, the new podcast from Jack Vanek of The Lady Gang. She talks with true crime TV producer Alexis Linkletter and the investigative journalist Billy Jensen about a chilling ride into the darkest corners of your worst nightmares, serial killers, murders, and cults. Listen every Wednesday on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcast. I want to go back to the book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us. What more do we need to learn about emotion and reason elevating that gap, amplifying the gap?
Well, I mean, I think that there are two basic approaches. I think that as individuals, we can try to be more reasonable. That is, we can recognize how our brains work, that we're operating largely in an intuitive way where we soak up the beliefs and values of the other people around us and the people we trust, and be aware of this and actively seek out information and, you know, be willing to question the things that we believe. On a broader social level, I think it's really the institutional structures that shape how information flows and what people end up believing as a result. And that, you know, the biggest levers, but the levers that are hardest to move, are the ones that work on people's intuitions. So, you know, while I think there are things that we can do to, you know, attempt to be more reasonable as individuals, I think ultimately if we're going to find our way out, it's going to be by restructuring our information environment so that we can have the kinds of sane, rational, fact-based discussions that democracy depends on.
Well, I mean, let's look at your day-in-day-out life is in Cambridge, right, at Harvard?
Yes.
I mean, just look at that institution. I don't understand. You know, we have people that are highly traumatized and very – we have a whole population of young adults that are used to being rescued by adults, and they can't seem to tolerate any impingement of that negative affect you were talking about when we talk about the valence of affect, good and bad affects. And our response to it is to go, well, let's protect them from all negative valence, as opposed to what we do clinically is like, let's expose them to it and help them manage it and regulate it. We're doing the anathema. We're doing the opposite of what we do in a clinical setting.
I'm somewhat skeptical of this. I mean, I spend a lot of time with undergraduates, and especially in the course that I teach, you know, we talk about, you know, tough, complicated issues. And, you know, there is a kind of sensitivity that maybe didn't exist or existed differently when I was in college now, you know, over 20 years ago. But what I find is that if you make it clear to whoever you're talking to that you respect them and that you're not dismissing them because of who they are, and that, you know, whatever it is that you disagree with them about, it's coming from a place of good faith, I find that students are willing to listen. They might not always agree, but I guess I'm not so convinced that there's really so much coddling going on. But you know, it sounds like your experience is different. What makes you think that we're in deep trouble when it comes to the way we're raising our young adults?
I'm not, my kids just went through, you know, elite institutions at Northeastern universities, and I've seen what's going on, and I was just sort of surprised that phenomenon of sensitivity to any speech that is impinging is amplified. rather than addressed, rather than encouraged to face head on. It's goes the other way. And maybe it's changing now. Maybe it's changing back. And I do see a lot of prestige in kids destroying people. That they get tremendous. I have my own Twitter feed where that, I see that stuff all the time. Where the biggest sense of prestige you can get is by ruining somebody's life who maybe misspoke or misstepped or whatever. And that's troubling. That's troubling. That's mob. That's mob action. That's I don't know.
I think that something is really is different. That just the. I mean, thank goodness I didn't grow up in the age of of Facebook and Twitter and whatever the undergrads are on these days. Just being able to sort of make some mistakes and have them disappear instead of every dumb thing you ever said is broadcast to everybody you know and available forever. I mean, that I think I think that it can explain why. People are maybe timid and fearful because even if most people don't like that kind of are not inclined to go nuclear anytime someone says something that they disagree with or even offended by, it only takes a small number of people to make the environment feel like it's
dangerous.
It's
dangerous.
Yeah.
And again, offense is the currency. Outrage is the currency. Yeah. That's what generates prestige. Let me spend the last couple of minutes talking about you a little bit. How did you get involved with this? How did you get interested? How did you end up a philosophy PhD? Tell me about that. Where'd you grow up?
Oh, well, so I grew up in Florida, in Boca Raton, went to school in Fort Lauderdale. And then I've been bouncing around the Northeast ever since then. I spent my first year of college at the Wharton School of Business at Penn, University of Pennsylvania. I realized pretty quickly that business was not for me, but got very excited about psychology, cognitive psychology, and evolutionary psychology, trying to understand how do our brains work and why are our brains shaped the way we're shaped. And I ended up transferring to Harvard, and I was an undergrad philosophy major there, but I always had the biology and the psychology in the back of my head. And as I was learning more and more about moral philosophy, which I also thought a bit about in high school and earlier even because I did a kind of philosophical debate as an activity, the psychology kept coming up, and I kept trying to think, well, we have these moral theories, but they're largely about making sense of the intuitions that we have about what's right or what's wrong. And
right.
Where do those intuitions come from in the first place? And that was really, what I was trying to understand is our sense of right and wrong from both a philosophical and a psychological and even a neuroscientific perspective. I mean, the work that I'm best known for is research using brain imaging and other methods combined with dilemmas from philosophy. So trolley dilemmas is when is it okay to kill one person to save five people? And as an undergrad, I had some ideas about, I'd taken a neuroscience class and was reading about these moral dilemmas, and something clicked where I kind of thought, I think that when people say that it's wrong to push the guy off the footbridge in order to save these five people, it made sense to me that response was coming from a particular circuit in the brain involving neural structures called the amygdala and the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and then the competing response that says, well, maybe it's better to save more lives in a different part of the brain called the frontal parietal control network. I started a philosophy PhD, finished a philosophy PhD, but I had the psychology and neuroscience bubbling in my head the whole time. And then I met a new faculty member at Princeton where I was doing my PhD named Jonathan Cohen. And I came to him and I said, I have this idea about how I think these moral dilemmas are what's going on in our heads, in our brains when we're doing this. And I think you could actually test this with functional neuroimaging, which was very new at the time. And he got it and thought it was great and said, okay, but you need to learn how to do this stuff. So while I was writing my philosophy dissertation on what's called meta-ethics, questions about the overall status of ethics, is there any fact of the matter about what's right or wrong, and questions like that, I started working on this brain imaging research, testing out these ideas about what's going on in our heads when we're thinking about moral dilemmas. And then that really took off, and I stayed in Cohen's lab for another 4 years and really learned how to do the research and made a little bit more progress. And then I was lucky that Harvard Psych Department was willing to take a chance on a philosopher who'd gotten into psychology and cognitive neuroscience. And so I got a job there and set up a lab, and now I've been here for about 12 years and continue to do this kind of work where I kind of let my philosophy background be my guide in terms of what questions to ask, but then I try to get at these things and get some traction using the tools of modern science.
I'm so glad you made a study discipline out of the neuroanatomical imaging, because it's not as simple as, you know, looking on a, you know, people imagine it's just looking at what lights up, and it's like, no.
Right.
And I hate some of these lay books that are out there, particularly ones that try to model addiction and love and those sorts of things. Like, no, this is way more. You can't make those. No. We're not there yet. You know, the fMRI, you know, neuroimaging is extremely, has to be interpreted. Is there anybody else material you're excited by now in that sort of area of neural imaging and motivation?
Well, I think that there have been a few things that have happened that have made neuroimaging more interesting in recent years. So one, and this has been around for a while, but people have only really started to make full use of it, is what's called multivariate methods. I mean, basically, you know, you talked about things lighting up. So what that means is you've got a region of the brain that is more active when people are doing one thing than something else. So to take a simple kind of boring example, if people are remembering a long string of numbers instead of a short string of numbers, the part of the brain that's working harder is the circuit frontal parietal control network, right?
which
you can see these.
Which, again, that's the network that you noticed was making a sort of a rational computation about morality as opposed to an emotional,
right.
Intense reaction emotionally.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But, yeah. but the more general methodological advance is that now a lot of brain imaging research is done with what's called multivoxel pattern analysis, which is basically it's looking for patterns of activity which may not be high or low, but that are just different, as opposed to just, is this region of the brain more active or less active?
It's patterning a brain response.
Yeah, so that it's just and what that enables you to do is to get at the contents of what people are thinking about. In a very crude way, but in a way where you could actually detect something.
Yeah.
The other thing is that brain imaging research has become much more about what we call functional connectivity. That is,
right.
Instead of just asking what's up or what's down,
wiring.
You ask which brain regions are at this time when the person is doing this talking to each other.
Yeah.
The waveform, the patterns are more synchronized.
Yeah.
And then putting those things together, or especially with functional connectivity, are computational models, right? Where you're not just saying I expect this to be higher or lower. Instead, you have an equation that tells you exactly what you think these different parts of the brain are going to be doing at different times, right? So let's say somebody is doing some complicated learning task where on a computer they're turning over different cards on different decks and learning things about what's high value and what's low value and winning and losing points, you might have a detailed model of how this learning process works, where you're expecting, let's say, you know, each new piece of accumulated evidence to carry a certain amount of weight, and you're expecting things to move backwards and forwards in terms of the hypotheses that you're testing. And, you know, you could have a more complicated story about what's going on. And what you're doing is not saying, you know, is there more or less activity now, but is the overall pattern of activity that we're seeing across this whole experiment consistent with this set of equations governing these circuits versus some other set of equations governing these circuits. And so
I'm not clear what that's going to teach us. Teach us sort of general. What's that going to teach us?
Well, now you know I getting a bit out of my own area.
Yeah.
Let's say you know in the domain of addiction, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to understand, you know, what goes on when people when people are becoming addicted and when they make the kinds of decisions that are
yeah.
characteristic of addicts.
Yeah.
Well, you know, some people think now that you know what's going on with addiction is that there's a kind of failed learning process, right? And that the same basic circuits that are involved in learning in general are being used, being short-circuited in a
yeah.
certain way when
yes.
people become addicted to a drug, right?
Right. That's
well,
right.
if you now this is not we're not there yet, but if you understand the precise principles that govern these learning circuits, right?
Yeah.
Then you can imagine having more precise interventions where you say, okay, this node in this network, it's not as active as it should be, and it's not playing the inhibitory role that it should.
Yeah.
And we're going to insert a microelectrode or make a kind of, genetic modification where you send a certain signal, which can actually be done with light now. So this is optogenetics,
yeah.
which is being done in animals, not in people.
Yeah.
That's going to upregulate this or downregulate it.
Yeah.
But if you want to have, you know, a physical intervention that is, you know, not just bathing the brain in some extra neurotransmitter or something like that, or you know, shocking people like, you know, ECT, but really fine-tuning the circuits, you have to understand how they work. You have to understand what are the general patterns that govern their behavior.
Got it.
Right?
And I guess there might be behavioral and cognitive behavioral ways to sort of upregulate or downregulate certain areas, too. Eventually, we'll figure out. Like specific
right.
interventions, yeah.
Right. So I think that we haven't, I mean, you know, in terms of real world, you might think of a clinical or behavioral kind of payoff. I think to a large extent, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
But you can at least see a path forward with some of these more sophisticated models of neural function that are coming out of a combination of neuroimaging work in humans and then more precise work in animal models that you can't do with people.
Well, I could talk to you all day, but we got to wrap it up, and I've got a million more things I want to talk about. But maybe I'll have to have you back and keep this conversation going. I really appreciate it. Maybe when your data, when are you going to publish that data about how to solve our problems?
Well, we just got our first wave of data last week, and it's going to be a long haul until we really sort of have our story wrapped up, but I don't know. Maybe in a couple of years.
I'm not going to wait that long.
Slow.
I'll get you back before then. But we'll follow you on Twitter at Morality Lab. Again, the website joshua-green.net, and the book Moral Tribes: Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Really appreciate.
So
I really appreciate spending time with us. And
again,
I want to talk about persuasion. I want to talk about other things we can do to help, you know, sort of bring people around and sort of the difference between educating and changing. There's so many different things I want to talk about, but we'll have to do it another time. And tonight, I'll just say thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right.
Have a good night.
Thanks so much.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's DRDREW Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or DrDrew.com.